Hello, you're listening to Radio EduTalk. This is John Johnson. It's Friday the 23rd of August. I'm at eAssessment Scotland 2013 in the University of Dundee. We've just finished listening to a keynote by Catherine Cronin, and we're going to have a wee bit of a conversation between Catherine and Carl Leidecker. Who is the VP Learning and Teaching at the University of Dundee. And maybe could just start by asking Catherine to introduce herself, give a wee bit of background of where you're from, how you got to where you are, and things like that, and we'll just take it from there.
Okay. Well, I'm originally from New York City, from the Bronx. Those are my roots. So I'm a New Yorker living in Galway, in the west coast of Ireland. I've lived in Galway for a long time, although I had 6 years of my life where I lived in Dublin. No. So I have my husband's from Scotland, and both my children were born when we lived here in Dublin. So I love coming back. I come back quite often, lots of family and friends. I work at the university in Galway. I am a lecturer and academic coordinator of our online IT programs. And I am loathe to always say that I'm a lecturer, because it's not what I do. And I think that our job descriptions haven't caught up with our practice yet. So hopefully they will at some stage. But I consider myself, as I said this morning, a networked educator, an open educator. And, you know, I try and encourage those practices with my students as well.
Yeah, we'll maybe get into some of the differences in there later on. And Carl, yourself?
Yes, I'm Carl Leidecker. I'm Vice Principal for Learning and Teaching at the University of Dundee. And I'm relatively new to the institution, having arrived here to start work on the beginning of July. Before that, I was at the University of Kent, so this is quite a big move for me up to this university. But I did spend 10 years, the first part of my career, at the University of Stirling in Scotland, so it's a bit like coming back to Scotland. I actually also lived in Dunblane for a little period of time.
And what years was that?
That was 95 to 2005.
Okay, we overlapped then. I was there from 92 to 98.
It's a small world.
It's a wonderful place.
It's getting smaller with us all being online. So Carl, this morning we heard Catherine talking about being open. Have you got any kind of initial, just fast reactions to this?
Yes, I mean, for me, it was quite eye-opening. I revealed last night that I have joined Twitter, but I have only followed two people and never yet sent a tweet. And I was just overwhelmed by the kind of world that is opening up, that I know is opening up, and that we need really to pursue. And we all need to do that. And I thought it was very powerful the way you talked about the way we need to connect across. And build those networks. I thought the most powerful moment was when you said that students should leave the university not just with a bunch of friends, a good degree, and some good memories, but they should leave with a kind of ready-made network there to support them throughout their lives and their learning and in their, I guess, socially as well as in their learning. I thought that was tremendously powerful.
Thank you.
So, just to get, there's obviously a wee tension, Catherine, between the social and the professional, say. I mean, in lots of different levels. And how do you manage to deal with, first, the sort of time that you need to engage in this openness with your students?
Yes. Well, it starts with my own practice, you know. So as I said, I'm a networked learner, so, you know, I would never suggest to anyone to, you know, to create an account, get on Twitter, and then start teaching with Twitter. So it's embedded really in my own practice of having been used to working with Twitter for a couple of years before I started teaching with it. And not just Twitter, but other open tools. So I think it's achieving an understanding of kind of the ecosystems of all these different spaces. And then when you're comfortable to a certain extent, opening up to students and saying, hey, I think we can use this space for learning. What do you think? And, you know, this is what I know. What do you know? And what can we learn together? And that's how I've always approached it, with Google+ and Twitter and Scoopit, you know, all the various tools that we use. You don't have to be an expert, but I also wouldn't go in cold. So the social media connections that I have with my students are integrated into my normal workflow, you know, that I have, because I'm very connected throughout the day.
Some people have concerns about connecting so closely with students mm-hmm. in a private sphere or quasi-private yes. as well as public, because it is yes. often seen as a private network, things yeah. like the use of Facebook and so on, where mm-hmm. you can shut it off to mm-hmm. friends and so on. I mean, does that cause any difficulties, you think, yeah, for I mean, teachers?
It's something I've thought a lot about and spoken with a lot of educators about, and my students, and I'm... Firstly, two main things I could say about that. Firstly is, I think it's really important before inviting students into open online spaces to ask them to think about their identity. You know, who do they want to be? So, for example, we decided to use Twitter. I ask the students if they have a Twitter account, but they'd like to use their existing one or create another one. You know, and quite often, because I've polled them, you know, they create another one because it's easier for them to say, whoa, that's my social identity. This is my learner identity. Now, what I see over time is many of them converge then, you know, over time. But it's very understandable that initially, if, mm-hmm. if they're asked to interact in a new way, that they might create another identity. And that's what's great about Twitter, because it doesn't have a real name policy like Facebook does. Mm-hmm. So really give the students a chance to think about how they want to represent themselves. Then we go into the space. And then the second point is, I tweet as Catherine Cronin, but when I teach with Twitter, I also have at CT231, which is our module code. So I ask the students to follow at CT231, everybody, and at CT231 follows them. If they choose to follow me, I tweet about other things as well, mm-hmm. not just art. If they choose to follow me, that's fine, and I tell them I'll do the same thing that I do with anybody who follows me. I'll click on their profile, look at their picture, look at their name, see their last few tweets, and if it's relevant to what I'm interested in, I'll follow them. And if it's not, I won't. But they're free to follow me. So, you know, I treat them just as I would anybody else. So that's the beauty for me of having a separate course account, because it kind of teases that out a little.
So is it a requirement of your courses that the students create a Twitter account? Or
yes, it wouldn't. I wouldn't think that it would be a requirement in most courses, but our course is professional skills, which is research skills, communication skills, and social media. So it is a requirement that they create a Twitter account. And I say to them that I don't care if they tweet after the course or not, or mm-hmm. you know, whatever, but that if you want to be an effective communicator today, you have to understand what the social media channels are. You know, so it's important to get in, kick the tires, see what it does. You know, we have this community. Now, some hardly tweet at all. Some tweet a little bit and then stop. A few usually grab it and go. But then those people can become the role models for the ones that might have been a bit more reluctant and take a little bit longer. So, you know, to me, it's not a definition of success if all 40 of them are tweeting. But if they all get in there and try it, then that's success. And then do with it what they will.
Yeah, I mean, I know some people are quite reluctant, and especially one of the people you're trying to encourage to be open is existing teachers.
Yes.
And I was, obviously, I'm from a primary school background, mm-hmm. and a while ago I was running a training course for teachers using wikis.
Yes.
And I had somebody who said, no, I just don't do this. Mm-hmm. I will not write yeah. online.
Yeah.
I'm saying, it's closed, it's private, yeah. it's anonymous. I won't yeah. do it.
Yes.
I'm interested.
Yes, there have always been one or two students mm. that have done that as well, and that is totally fine. I mean, that you know, we're all adults coming to this learning together. So that, you know, as I said, I don't assess what they're doing on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't assess their tweets, but an understanding of Twitter and how to share and hashtags and so on is part of what's assessed in the final digital media project. So
could a student be successful? In their assessment just by observing other students?
Absolutely, because really, by creating something that's open, tagging it, maybe using appropriate hashtags, because they understand what hashtags are, because we've got them visible in class. Even if they don't choose to do that, they're making the work available for other people, and the tags and the hashtags enable the appropriate people to find it. So they can still demonstrate that understanding without doing it. They choose not to.
One of the striking slides that you showed was the kind of take-up of social media across the generations in
yes.
a very rapid period of time. One forgets that it only really is the last 5, 6, 7 years that we've
yes.
seen this huge explosion. In that time, in the way in which you have looked at the way in which your students are producing work, the quality of the work they're producing, so that the value that is being added, I mean, what are the things, if you took a skeptic and said, well, you know, are you producing totally different students in the way in which they're able to learn, the way in which they interact? What has been the added value and the change you've seen over that period?
Well, what one thing I think is really interesting is that a lot of people are worried about students having other identities, you know, like a funny Twitter name or whatever. However, when assessment is a private transaction between a student and me, I would have been aware that a lot of students wrote in an inauthentic voice because they write what they think you want to see. And maybe it doesn't mean that much to them. They just want to get it off. What do you need? Here it is. And it's not an authentic voice. Whereas when we develop skills in open online spaces where they realize the classroom is connected to the world, and then you ask them to create something that's going to be in an open online space, I hear authentic voices. You know, it doesn't matter what their Twitter handle is. They're creating work that are things that they're passionate about, as I mentioned, guitar or building a computer or whatever. And B, they know this is going out into the world and anybody could listen, so, you know, they put a lot into it. So I see more authenticity in the students' work now than I did before because of putting it into open spaces.
And do they reflect on that authenticity? Do you try to get them to understand what they have actually learned in the course of this interaction?
Yes, one of the pieces of assessment in that course is a reflection of social media, kind of who they were on social media before, what their digital identity was, because we do a kind of a Google search of themselves. They do it themselves at the start of the term, and sometimes they're surprised at what they find. So I ask them to reflect on all of that. Yes, I think that's important for them in terms of self-assessment, mm-hmm. and also for me in terms of improving my teaching. Mm.
Do you think by publishing online that even if they're not being assessed by their peers in any formal way, because if you publish something online you feel as if you're being assessed, that will make somebody bring, I think Jim Groom calls it, their A game?
Yes.
Yeah, it will make them work harder on online.
Definitely. Yes.
Because it's in the open.
And, you know, they know that if it's something that they're proud of, which for very many of them it is. You know, we talk about the notion of an e-portfolio. We don't use a particular e-portfolio system, but you know, I explain that their CV and their LinkedIn profile can link to their work. You know, and I talk about second-year students, so you know, I say, well, start now, you know, mm-hmm. and you'll get better at this, and you'll get your LinkedIn profile created now. And they all acknowledge the fact that in any social network that they're a part of, when you first join it, you're a bit of a neophyte, and you know, you don't really understand the norms. And LinkedIn is like that as well. Mm. So if they want to be using LinkedIn, for example, you know, when they're looking for work at the end of fourth year or even for placements at the end of third year, get the profile up, maybe link to some of the work that they've done, that they're proud of, and kind of grow that profile so it's there and mature and something they're proud of, you know, by the time they're soon to be graduates. Mm.
Do you think there are risks involved in this?
Absolutely, yes. That's what I said in my conclusion. There are always risks. You know, it's distressing every week. You know, we hear about online bullying and what's going on with AskFM, and you know, people have different opinions. What I'm often dismayed at is that the arguments end when people criticize social media, but it's behavior on social media. So I think the biggest risk is not doing this. To be perfectly honest, you know, as a parent and as an educator. Because children are picking up these tools, they're learning from each other. So unless there are voices and presences in their lives of people using these tools in other ways, you know, the students whose words I shared, you know, oh, I can use social media as a learner. I mm-hmm. can connect with people whose work I'm reading and so on. How else will they learn that, you know, unless we invite them to those spaces?
Yeah, do you think schools need to be modelling and then giving students the opportunity to participate in these spaces so that they practice in the same way as you give them modelling in maths and an opportunity to practice what they learn?
Absolutely.
There shouldn't really be any difference. And again, it's a wee bit like you were saying, drop a digital.
Yeah.
It's not digital literacy, it's not digital media, it's just...
It's citizenship.
Yep.
It's you know, network literacy. Yep. Yeah.
I've got a wee... One of your slides you were showing, I think the one you referred to with the rise in social media and the way people use social media, and there's obviously this great enthusiasm now for just putting stuff online. You're saying your kids are doing 16 different types of social media at the same time. I've got a concern about the difference between closed systems like Facebook or Google Plus, and that people just rush into them, get very enthusiastic about them without looking at the sort of longer term consequences, because these systems, although they appear open, aren't open. And do you think, are you doing anything towards thinking about this idea of your owning your own digital identity, using your own space, rather than the silos that are made by Google or Facebook?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have not done having the students create a domain of one's own, like Jim Graham's work, but I'm totally inspired by it, and I've been following the work that they're doing, and they're going to be starting a new initiative in September, as far as I understand, and I'd like to go there, because and I've heard Audrey Waters speak this year as well, and follow Audrey's work closely, you know, and there are a few pioneers there who I think really have got it right. Now we do talk in the course that I teach about the, you know, the filter bubble, and, you know, looking at, you know, who owns your data in different places, you know, at least getting the students to be aware of thinking about those things. So, but that's as far as I've taken it at the moment. So as I say, I'm trying to push my practice on all the time. So although I haven't done that yet, that's where it was, where I'd like to go.
Yeah.
Definitely. Are you aware of anybody else who's doing that in Scotland, or?
I'm just aware of the tension that I feel using, Google Plus, for instance, where I can't access the data I've put in there, and very often I can't even find the things that I've liked 2 weeks ago. One of the things I think about Twitter, although it is a closed silo, and although they have closed down considerably over the last couple of years, they've still got a reasonably searchable API, and, you know, you can get stuff out of Twitter still. I don't know how long that'll last, but I think that's very important, and I think the idea of owning our own spaces is really important, because it'd be lovely to start that in primary school and give every child a domain.
And that
carries on with them, and they can use it as they like. And they would have to start off using specific tools, having it maybe locked down perhaps in some way, but allowing them to grow into that space.
So we need to work with teachers, don't we, really? Because, you know, a lot of teachers are doing this, and very many teachers are really threatened by those things. So, again, I've developed liaisons with primary and secondary school teachers. We're just sharing what we know and using social media in education. How are you doing it, and how are you doing it? And I think that's, there's great potential there. Rather than primary teachers relying just on primary system and primary professional development, so on, secondary likewise, and so on.
I have children of primary school age. I have a daughter of 9 who, you know, uses our iPad in very controlled circumstances, but would like her own device and so on. And I must say, I'm facing that dilemma now about at what stage should a child have this, beginning to have this open identity, which is such a powerful tool, but also does carry those risks. And part of me is a little bit traditional, says, you know, I'd like to protect her childhood from the kind of digital age that we're all totally surrounded by, and I would like her actually to talk to us rather than withdrawing and being on, you know, so that she creates the community within the family. And do you think there are some dangers for family life and for close personal interactions? We've all sat at a dinner table where or watched people at dinner tables where they don't actually talk to each other anymore.
That's fascinating, because as a parent myself, I understand that reaction completely. When my children were young, it was similar, because we know all the risks, don't we? It's just like everything else when they go out for the first time. You know, we're terrified, and they say, I'm just going to the pub. But we know all these things that they don't know. So they see the positive aspects, and, you know, going on online is similar. Anne Collier, netsafety.org, has a brilliant phrase that I've used for years. I have done e-safety sessions with schools for many years, and she says that the best filter is between your ears. So that wish that we have to lock things down, which is appropriate when children are really small, really we need to take off the training wheels and be developing their judgment over time, and the way I've done that, it's a continuum. It's not, you know, it's locked down and it's open. It's locked down, and then you're doing it sitting with them, sitting next to them, and then when they're doing it on their own, you know, initially I had their passwords, and then, you know, so really it was partnering all along until the point where, you know, off they go, just like the training wheels.
That's very hard to control in a society where not all teachers are able to have that time, and all parents have that
thing.
It's just the reality of the world.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, I mean, my daughter is now 23, and you have internet access in the living room until you're a certain age, and we've got, you know, that you have began to develop this filter, and then you can have access elsewhere. But nowadays, it seems I wouldn't like to try and estimate the number of children who have video, audio, online
in
their private space, or in their pockets.
But I mean, even at night, you know, if you're home together and they go to bed, you know, they're under the covers. And so that's it. That's why we have to talk about it, is about communication. And, you know, my daughter's 20, my son's 15, and, you know, they have their own devices and they're online when they choose, but we talk all the time you know, about different things. And, so, you know, it's fun. You know, I'll say, did you see this and did you see that? And so it can be a vehicle for communication as well.
So there's a problem then for teachers who are not au fait with online behaviour.
That don't have digital or network literacy.
They don't do that. And there's, an awful lot of them.
Yeah.
And I remember, this is going back, say, 2005, I started the kids in the class blogging and connecting with other kids, and it was great, and we thought we were, you know,
the bee's knees.
This was gonna, and then I found out people have been doing this in 1999.
So you were bee's knees.
And then it never has caught on. We seem to get waves at the moment. There's another wave of teachers driven largely by Twitter and a few really exciting projects, I think, in Britain, which is encouraging children to go into this space again.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it's just going to tail off unless they get a very strong steer from the leadership.
Yes, I agree with you. And I suppose that was my approach this morning, because I don't think it's about let's teach teachers to use Twitter or let's teach to use whatever. It's really more about this whole definition of citizenship, digital citizenship, understanding that networked publics are the new publics, and, you know, just what you said there. Because I think once that awareness comes, then you realize that we must do this, and then people don't need to be talked into it. So I think that's the education piece that really needs to happen, rather than will we get everybody an iPad or a tablet or what, you know, different conversation.
Yeah, a completely different one, and it's about life and teaching and learning rather than about,
and what are we doing here?
About toys. Yeah. Okay, I think we could probably wrap it up there unless you get any final points. I'll post this online as soon as possible, and I'll put in the relevant URLs. I would really encourage people to have a wee look at your slides on SlideShare, because there's some great points there. I've got a huge list of questions here that I haven't asked or talked about, but this is great. So can I just say, Carl and Catherine, just thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.